Welcome back. I'm Henrik, and you're listening to Red Ice Radio. Busy week, a lot of shows and a lot of developments in the works. If you're new to the program, redicecreations.com is the website. You can hear the first hour of our show, sometimes both, not only through our website. We are also on YouTube, SoundCloud, TuneIn, and Stitcher. You can subscribe to our RSS feeds, Red Ice Radio, Radio 314, and we have a news feed as well. Today we have a return visit from Kurt Doolittle to discuss his declaration of a new direction for the new right. Or rather, how a stake has now been driven into the heart of the old right. It's dead, it's gone, it's over. Thank the gods for that. Kurt is behind propertarianism.com. If you missed the first show we did with Kurt, I recommend that you tune in and listen to that. It's from June last year, 2015. We are going to go over a few background details in the first hour and talk about how this restructuring is manifesting itself. And then in the second hour, it's going to get brutal and harsh as we face a potential reality of actions that will drive our declared enemies from our heartland. You definitely don't want to miss what Kurt has to say about this. But we'll begin nice and easy. Bear with us, folks. Some great things coming through in this program. So stay tuned. Kurt, welcome back to Red Eyes Radio. Always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming back on the show again.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Love your show.
Thank you so much. Well, we have a lot to discuss. You know, you were with us in late June last year, 2015. The migrant crisis, invasion, whatever you want to call it, hadn't really kicked into high gear at that point yet. It was just waiting to happen. But we, and this is something I want to tie into the discussion a bit later to see how that's kind of changed the dynamic of some of the things that we discussed last time and the overall picture of European awakening, if you will. But tell us a bit about, one of the reasons I wanted to get you on the show is to talk a bit about some of the new declaration of sorts for the direction of the new right, if you will. You wrote a really good piece on your website about it. You've been very active in trying to get that message out. Tell us, give us an overview of that, Kurt.
I've been trying to get across the point that we're not the alt-right anymore. Other guys are saying the same thing, saying they call movement conservatism is ended. But I would say that that we're not the alt-right anymore. We're the new right. And I think we have to stay on that message. And now I'm not doing this as just some pop culturalist saying create reality by chanting in the postmodern sense. I'm saying that I think it's just true. It's true because the premise of the older rights, you know, both the traditional right in America, the neocon right, and the movement right, these have all failed. These have all failed, and they failed because their premises are wrong. The premise that we can that once people become enfranchised and get a membership, they'll wise up and join the great Western aristocracy of everyone. Well, that clearly failed. That project failed. Probably during the Second World War. The post-war conservative movement, all through the Goldwater movement, well, you know, culminating in probably Kirk's intellectual work, I guess. If I talk about it structurally, this is a bunch of narrative nonsense. It doesn't really propose anything. It's asking us to return to faith, except just like Kant provided the Germans with an alternative to faith, Kirk was trying to provide us with the same kind of pseudo-rational return to faith. And the neocons, they were just saying, well, we can, now that we've conquered the Soviet Union, we don't have to sell this message, we can sort of enforce it. And the movement neocons and the somewhat libertarian movement, they all said, well, we can just, people will get it once they understand. Well, I think what's happened is that we can look at this on all sorts of levels and realize that I can lose the audience because I'm trying to make too many points at one time. So I'm hoping you're going to protect me from that.
we'll try to break it down. Yeah.
So I just said there were a bunch of movements and they all failed. They all failed because the premise is wrong. Is that people aren't going to adopt our way. Our way is very unique. And I think what you see in most of the alt-right literature and most of the alt-right posts is an attempt to say, but man is man. Man isn't Rousseauian man. Man isn't Lockean man. It's not Kantian man. It's not Ashkenazi Jewish Enlightenment man. It's not American American's view of a common man who's an aristocracy of everyone. You know, the perfect middle class society. Those are all falsehoods. What man is an incredibly practical creature that's no different from any other creature on this planet. And this whole fallacy of equality that was just a narrative by which we could gain enough support to overtake the monarchies, this was all just a great big fantasy that we built a huge amount of literature in every capacity. You know, we built it at the children's story level, at the mythological level. We built it at the intellectual level. We created pseudosciences to support it. And, you know, our pseudosciences have run their course. You know, Boasian social pseudoscience has run its course. We've disproved that. The Freudian Freudian psychological pseudosciences is fit run its course. To some degree, people like me are trying to end Cantor's pseudoscience, which is this concept of multiple infinities, when he's just actually removing a property, which I cannot possibly get into and not lose everybody. Mises's pseudoscience, which is that he tried to say that say that a logic was the same thing as a science. Rothbardian pseudoscience, he tries to say that ethics can be based on property alone rather than non-conflict. Keynesian pseudoscience, which is that we can escape full accounting. In other words, we can ignore the externalities if we increase consumption enough, that will compensate for in wealth for any negative externality we can produce. We've eliminated the pseudoscience of man's equality, which just that pretty much any population, anybody who's in the 80s is a real problem for every population. And and I think we've have to confront the truth, which is that Western success is the product not of our great virtue, but the fact that we just eliminated aggressively the underclasses for thousands of years, right. And so we don't have the underclass to deal with, and so we don't have the phenomenon that has plagued, that probably took down the looks like it took down the Islamic Empire, and it certainly took down the Roman. You don't have the problem of bringing in the evil 80s, so to speak, and taking down your civilization so much so that no matter what you do, South America being an example, the upper class can't carry it. There's no way to organize. Am I too deep now? But I'll make this one point. There's no way to organize incentives so that you can organize all those people into doing good. You just can't. There's just no way that small a population, with those few resources, over those people who are that unproductive, can create enough productivity that you can arrange the results of that productivity to provide incentives for everyone. So they're ruined, right? These people are ruined, and we now have taken it on. And I think that's what's changed, is that we've had a century to disprove these pseudosciences, these Enlightenment mythos, and these lies, we comfortable lies that we told ourselves so we could justify taking power and economic power into our own hands and taking it from the nobility.
Equality, democracy, and all these things, of course, they have run its course, right? And what else can you say in terms of where it has left us? Like, where are we on that page now?
Well, we're on the page that most groups get to, is that we're entering the Caesar phase, when you sort of the population has done its moral best to resist the malincentives of its commercial and its political sector, and now we're at the point where we've said enough. We're demanding a Caesar to come fix it. Now, that's an American way, because we have a Trump, right? But what you're seeing in Europe is not a demand for Caesar, but just the revolt of saying we've had enough. And, of course, we've had enough because comforting lies are okay, right? I mean, we all tell each other white lies, you know, and governments tell us white lies too. You know, nobody's government's going to tell you that, yeah, you guys are useless, right? I mean, there's really not much value to you at all. And your dead weight on the economy, I mean, that doesn't help anything. Your dead weight on the rest of us, that doesn't help. So, but, you know, at some point, comforting lies are actually excuses by which your entire civilization is harmed. And I think what we've seen is those of us who have longer time preferences, you know, we call ourselves conservatives or conservative libertarian, those of us with long time horizons, we were born by nature to think this way, we have reached the limit of our tolerance for these comforting lies.
I'll definitely want to ask you more about Trump and what he represents in all this later. But before we go there, you're talking about a new right. How has this noticeably kind of showed itself as something of an influence of saying, kind of there is a new way, and obviously we do have people that are attracted to it. It's gaining, you know, traction in that regard. It's getting some mainstream, notice and all of that. But what can you say in terms of how it's gained influence and where it's going to go?
Well, first of all, the people listen to us, and they've lost trust. We actually, I mean, what you see is that the people have gotten to the point where, like, you've betrayed us. Your philosophy hasn't worked. Your strategy hasn't worked. The only thing to do is throw the bums out. And you're seeing that, certainly saw that in Germany yesterday. Mm. You're seeing that in America. We're going to throw the bums out. And those people are desperately trying to hold on to the pressure. What I think you're asking me is, how do we know that we're being successful? Well, right. We know successful because you can see the increase in the interest in your work and mine and other people's work. And I think that the second thing you can see is from my perspective as a social scientist, I can see it that it affects all levels. So you're having the emotional, sentimental group talk about it. You're having the rational, moral group talk about it. You're having the historical analogical group talk about it. You're having the economists, economic politicals talk about it. You're having the people who are interested in genetics and these things talking about it. You're having guys like me, or at least not too many of us, but because it's a hard thing, but put together a pretty hard analytic philosophy that the rest of the world, that the rest of conservative movements have all failed at. And I know the reason. We can look back, and since this is my territory, we can look back at why the conservatives were failed at producing a rational rhetoric for the advocacy of their ideas, because it's democratically unacceptable.
Right. Okay.
And so you can't have a right that is trying to preserve, trying to establish limits on consumption, when the whole holy religion of your whole culture is built on the advance of consumption. Consumption's only a good as long as it's not causing externalities or long-term harms, right? But, you know,
explain externalities so people know what you mean when you say that.
So if, you know, when I, it's like the idea of a butterfly flaps its wings and causes a tornado somewhere else. Well, that's an externality, right? I mean, why would the butterfly flap? Well, it matters. Well, it's the same thing with an externality is anything that happens as a consequence of it's unintended consequences, right? So there are unintended consequences to all these democratic behaviors. Now, an unintended consequence that we've run into is that we've found out it's actually more important that you get rid of the dumb people and the evil people than it matters if you have a lot of smart people. There's a wonderful book that just came out on this recently. I'll find it and send it to you. And so what's happened is we have been building up. We've spent thousands of years through manorialism and hanging trying to get trying to eliminate these the evil 80s from our population. And we did a pretty good job of it. Even if we didn't eliminate the 80 IQs, what we eliminated was the impulsivity, which is actually a bigger problem than impulsivity and aggression, than is the lack of intelligence. So we've worked very hard at that. And in 100 years, since we brought women into the voting pool, they have followed their strategy, which is to make it possible for their offspring, no matter how awful, in objective terms, to prosper at the expense of that long-term capital that we've built that was the very thing that rescued us from the ignorance and poverty of the past. So, I mean, Western tradition, we'd like to make it this nice narrative, but I mean, if you talk about it, we're the most Darwinian people ever came along.
Right.
And that doesn't sell under democracy.
Especially no, it doesn't.
It doesn't sell under democracy when it's women. Now, you know, anyway, I'm being selfish and trying to make a point instead of answering your question, which is that you would say, so we've made this argument now. You can see this argument flourishing at every layer, every 15 points of IQ, so to speak. You know, you've got a different narrative structured with different rules, but the narrative's consistent from the very bottom of I'm just tired of this. These guys are liars and scumbags. You know, over the long term, we're not going to be able to hold together any kind of advanced civilization. At the intellectual level, these people have all failed because you can't. We've been telling a convenient lie instead of working with the truth. And so, I think what's happened is we now have permission to tell the truth.
And that's kind of happening, right? Because I mean, one of the both the problems and the good things, opportunities here is. You know, how do we jump on this as people get disenfranchised? They can see that things are failing. We have to be there to offer something. We have to be there to jump on this opportunity, basically, to try to regain both control. But this is a way to salvage, of course, everything that now is being lost. It's not
that's
just
right.
A fact, you know.
Well, because we have two things, right? We have we have empirical evidence, right? We have biological science, especially since the 90s, right? And we're going to get a lot more in the next very few years because it's coming out pretty aggressively now. So, and we have, at least in my work, and I'm going to promote my own work, but I mean, only because I think it's probably true, is that we have an intellectual basis. So if we can take this, we can take the empirical evidence, the science that supports it, and the theory that controverts it, and we can turn that into a positive narrative, not a criticism of the past, but a positive narrative, a solution to the present, I think we've got an answer. What I don't like about our community, all right, is we've been complaining a long time, and complaining isn't providing a solution.
Exactly. And also, let me ask you this, though, Kurt. I mean, you talk about science, you talk about truth, empirical evidence to show and all that. One of the other criticisms that I've heard is basically that that's all well and good, and that should be there as a kind of foundational underlying structure that supports what we're trying to convey and get across. But we have failed utterly on the, for example, the emotional appeal of marketing this in the right way, if you see what I'm saying.
I don't know how you say that when Jonathan Haidt is probably the most innovative guy, says the right owns the moral debate.
No, I'm not saying about the moral issue. I'm saying that to show that it's an emotional issue, right?
Well, you know, it's an emotional issue because people can't speak irrationally. I mean, if you had something positive to say, we want this versus these people are bad, then we want this solution versus these people, you know, have been damaging to us or we shouldn't do this, that's very different. It's like saying, well, actually, we've been doing all these bad things, but if we just stop doing these few bad things, then we'll be okay. No, I mean, the truth is, our whole experiment, Enlightenment-era experiment with democracy has been a catastrophe. Mm. And so somebody says, well, let's go back to authority. This is like what the child does, right? You do what you understand.
Right, yeah.
What you understand is limited to what you know. But if you actually know how to do something that could restore what we did in the past and wouldn't be a problem for the other side, they wouldn't like it as much as their hyper-consumption, but they'd have a hard way of resisting it, then you could have a solution you could recommend. My problem with the transferring the alt-right into the new right, which I think we have emotionally and experientially departed the past. We all know this myth. You know, this mythos is gone. We don't believe that democracy is the way, or that human beings are going to do the right thing. We've left that era behind. The problem is, what do we recommend instead? You know, you're not going to just say, you know, we have to have something to recommend instead. And so the past failed, the past right movements failed, is because they lacked both a solution. They both lacked a solution. They had the wrong premises to work on, right? They were believing fallacies about mankind. They had no solution. They had no, is that three things? Did I cover all three? I'm sorry. Somebody's distracting me.
Okay.
they continued this religious, this semi-moral religious narrative. They never came up with a solution, and they were based on a program of fallacies. Well, from our standpoint, we can fix the problem of we no longer believe those fallacies anymore, but do we have a solution for it? And my answer is that you know, it's actually pretty hard to come up with a solution for it. All we have is people going back to Caesarism, you know, authoritarianism. But like I said on another show the other day, the minute it's great when you get a Caesar until you get a Nero. Theoretically, you know, you look at it, certainly, what's her name's a Nero? Merkel's a Nero.
That's correct.
Burning down Western civilization there because she has this silly humanism. Well, you know, in the Russian Empire, they need to have this idea. But for us, we don't need it. So we have to be the new right, we have to talk about what we want. We have to make demands. We have to push out those demands. And then we'll create a debate, not about whether it's whether these statements about man are right or wrong, or whether people in the past have been good or evil, but whether these solutions will work or not. And so that's a different conversation to have. Meanwhile, the left has created a bunch of pseudosciences and spread them through our university system. And that pseudoscience has allowed them to create this tragic narrative that we live in.
Well, exactly. I mean, I repeat this every day almost. It all stands and falls on this premise of equality, right? That when they look at society, they see problems such as you know differences in salaries and inequality, and why do this group doesn't have why don't they have the kind of jobs that this group has, etc. In their universe, in their world, everyone is equal, right? They go from that premise, which means that obviously it's a systemic error that the percentile of every group is not equally distributed across every field, right? So they're working with the government.
That's the female reproductive strategy, right? She has very little control over the quality of her offspring, and so she wants her offspring to persist. She allies with other women to make sure their offspring can persist. We ally with other men to make sure we control access to fertility, so we can persist our genes. And there's nothing more. And so we have a different reproductive strategy than women do. We have a very long, because our production cycle is the tribe. We have a very long-term view of right and wrong. We want the tribe to be strong. They don't. They don't care if we're the group of males that come in, or the next group of males comes in, or the group of males comes after that, because their genes persist either way. I'm sorry to anthropomorphize genetics a la, what's his name with the selfish gene, Dawkins. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it helps to illustrate the point is that, you know, the women intuit certain things, beta males intuit certain things. Alpha and non-beta males, whatever you want to call us, those of us who are desirable and capable and compete, we desire different things. We want to have capital chase us. So, you know, we all have different interests. The error here is partly ours. It's not that we want to agree to them. It's whether we'll permit them to do it. Because their job is to nag, and our job is to use violence. And our, in other words, our function in history. So our job is not to we can perform a trade with them, but it's not to try to convince them that we're right, because in their view we're wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And that's not a question of morality. That's just true. So we're wrong. We can't convince them we're right, because we're actually, in their view, we're wrong. We're against their interests. So the question is, we can either come to a compromise where we both gain, which is what the family has done for us, what most of our history has done, what the market does for us, or we can just establish limits and say, no, you can't do that, or we'll just, you know, end all this nice world you have because we have the capacity to do it. And or we can take the Islamic view or the totalitarian view, is that we're just going to lay down rules and there is no more trade. It's just our way. So the way you say this is you would like it your way. We would like it our way. The only ways to achieve it through mutual satisfaction is the way that we've done through cooperation throughout our entire history, which is to compromise. What will you give us so that we get what we want? What we want is to limit your ability to profit at the expense of the tribe, which is what conservatives do. I mean, we don't think of it that way, but that's what our instincts tell us. Mm-hmm. And we say, well, you know, profit is all in good. It just can't come at the expense of the tribe. But that's not what a progressive thinks. They're like, I want profit for me and mine no matter what. The tribe is my enemy because it's trying to constrain me. So we can't ask them to believe. We don't sit there and try to negotiate with them convince them that we're right. That's trying to get a discount ourselves. What we want to do is provide a solution. Now, the problem is nobody's proposed a solution as how we compromise because we used to have the family, right? And we did this through marriage and we did all those family things in the family. And then we took not one man, one vote, but one family, one vote. And we brought that to the community, and we said, on behalf of my family, which is the men and women in my family, I want the tribe to do this, or the fang to do this, or the jury to do this, or the government to do this. Well, when we let women in, now we have lost the family as a method of compromise, and we've actually empowered women to do through the use of our government to do the opposite, which is destroy the family in the method of compromise and return us to dysgenic reproduction, which is in their interests. I mean, people talk about all the time about civilizing man or domesticating man and removing violence from. But a woman's just as dangerous as man is. She has her offspring at will and puts the rest of us in moral hazard trying to ensure this child, even though it's incredibly bad for us.
Right.
And so why does a woman have the right to have children at will if I don't have the right to thieve at will? It's the same thing. It's the same problem. So why does a woman have that right? Well, she doesn't. I mean, because I don't have the right to thieve at will. Why do we talk about politicians thieving from us? But you know what we've done is we brought in we had the Yamnaya come over here and bring aristocracy with them. We spent a couple of thousand years domesticating mankind, raising it out of ignorance and poverty twice, only to be set back by the hordes. And we're sitting here wondering, worried about equality. Well, you know, man isn't a good creature. That he's a super predator that has been domesticated just like cows and wheat and peas. You know, there's no difference between domesticating those creatures. We make them conform. The way you know a creature's been domesticated is really impulsivity, aggression, and intelligence.
Right.
Possibly. Yep. Right? That's how you know. And so we just domesticated the West. We did so for some accidental reasons. It wasn't like we knew what we were doing. It just made sense to us and worked out. Well, you know, we have to say to ourselves, well, you know, the right is has to say, well, you know, if we want to preserve the value, the virtues of Western civilization, which are the results of all this truth, and the results of all the innovation and creativity that come from this use of truth, then we have to demand truth from others, and we have to limit theft from others. That's our job, is to continue domesticating. So why do you think we're going to get off on this job by talking? We're not going to get this job done by talking about it. We're going to put in some rules and negotiate, and we'll try to come to some rules where we can conduct mutually beneficial trades. But if we can't conduct mutually beneficial trades, we only have one choice. It's not to convince, it's to prosecute.
Take a step back for us there, Kurt, as well, and explain the parties involved in this negotiation so people are on your page and know exactly what you're talking about here.
You know, I'm not all that much of a free market capitalist in the sense, but you know, from a calculator standpoint, the market's really beautiful, right? It captures information from all over the place and sends signals to each other to tell us what to do. And we don't really have to have any kind of consensus at all. We can just all selfishly pursue our interests with the information available at our disposal. So we build this amazing world, not by cooperating on ends, but by cooperating on means. There's no monopoly in that market. We try to avoid monopoly in that market, right? And what we produce in that market are things that we consume, right? They're things for our consumption or ownership or what we call privatization. But what we need government for is that we need a market for commons, not things that we can consume, but things we can invest in that no one can consume. Mm-hmm. That's what a commons is. It's a thing you can. We have use. You have usus and fructus, which is allow. You can use it and you can bear the fruits of it, but you can't convey it. You know, transfer it to somebody else. You can't harm it or destroy it or limit the future production of it by anybody else. So you have to be able to produce commons. And when, you know, one of the problems of libertarianism is Rothbardianism is a war on the production of commons. These can't be produced this way. What we want instead with the commons is we go back to Westerners. What is property rights? What are truth telling? Well, these are commons. These are common behaviors we created, and they're expensive. Think about what the price of, nobody else produced truth telling, what's the price of truth telling? In other words, what's the value of us telling truth to each other, to having juries, to having judges, to having a common law? What's the value of that in all our lives compared to not having that? Why is that process of common law, judge, and jury so similar to the scientific method? It's because they're the same. So we have this incredible, we didn't invent science because it was something new. We invented science because we did it. So what is science? Well, it's the method by which we arrive at the ability to make truth propositions, to say truthful things. Yep. That's what science is. So science is the process of telling truth. Philosophy has largely denigrated into the process of lying. So Marx being a genius at it. So we produced over time these incredibly expensive commons, and commons are the West's competitive advantage. Because the same reason we tell truth and can build and have property rights and is the same reason we can create open public spaces. The same reason we behave in a sanctified manner in the church and we behave in a sanctified manner toward the property in the commons is the same. So we Westerners weaponized the ability to produce commons. So it's incredibly powerful for us to produce commons. And so that's why you need government, is that it's our competitive advantage. It's part of the infrastructure of our competitive advantage, just like rivers were part of the infrastructure of our competitive advantage in building transportation and trade routes. So in our government, we need to go back to saying, well, what allows us to produce these commons in the new world we live in? Well, let's go back to the old world and see if we can learn something from it. We had the aristocracy, the monarchy, we call the House of Commons, but really the House of the middle class. And we had the church for the lower class. Well, those groups would use the parliament or the government as a means of conducting trade. They used it like a market, the same way we use markets today. But what was good about those markets is that each constituency, each sports team, so to speak, you know, each class had its own house. So these houses could negotiate on behalf of their constituencies. What happened when we put in universal democracy is two things. First, we got to pure majority rule instead of a market. In other words, we created a monopoly production of commons instead of a market for the production of commons. And we gave that monopoly to the largest number, the lower class. The second thing we do is we brought in women. And women vote more consistently because they have more narrower interests. They vote more consistently across the spectrum. So what we got was we got a monopoly of the very opposite. We created government that created a monopoly of commons production. You ask me this question, why is it necessary that commons be produced in a monopoly? My favorite example is the one that we've been using in Seattle for the past 10 or 15 years. Some of us want to have a subway-like system, and some of us want to have the monorail.
Monorail, yep.
Now, you know, these actually represent two class visions of the future, right? The Star Trek vision of the universal upper middle class, and the socialist vision of the we're all happy proletariats with our chickens running around in C class. And so what happened here is that, of course, the state wants the proletarian service, and the upper caste wants the middle and upper caste. We want the monorail service. We can have only one or the other because the government's involved. Well, the truth is there's no reason we can't have both and let competitions tell us which one's better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So why do we need monopoly production of commons? The second thing is you asked me how do I explain this? Well, the point is, why do we need monopoly production of commons? If there's enough money to do incredibly stupid things like go on adventures overseas, why can't we have multiple commons? Why do we need to concentrate all our wealth behind one decision? Why can't we split those decisions into trade? So, well, if you want that social program, I want this infrastructure program, and I want this military program, and I want this this education. Right? Why can't we do that? Well, we can't because we have everybody munch together in the lower class instead of having each class advocate for its interests. So the second thing that happens in this monopoly is we have rule by assent rather than objection by dissent. So when you're creating this monopoly by voting, you get everybody to agree to it, and then we have to go by it. So the only thing that gets through is everything everybody agrees to, or everything everybody's been bribed to agree to, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem with our system. Whereas if it was a market, well, the problem is as long as it's not illegal, you can do it. In other words, as long as I'm not stealing from anybody, I can do it. So why can't we have a government where groups can create, produce commons as long as they don't impose costs on anybody else? So why don't we actually have create a market government rather than a monopoly government? Why do we have to have everybody agree in order to do that? Why can't you spend your money every year toward this goal, and this group spend their money toward that goal?
Mm-hmm.
And over time, both of us all get our goal. No, it has to be somebody wins and somebody loses, which creates animosity and frustration, and usually provides the worst possible incentives to politicians. The third thing is, why do we have to have politicians? Now, the reason we had politicians was distance, right? Distance and knowledge. Well, you know, what we found is that politicians actually, they create a great opportunity for corruption. They create every possible disincentive. We want them to act in the common man's interest, but they don't. They act in their constituents' interest. Who's their constituents' interest? It's the people who got them elected. Who got them elected? Well, their parties, their special interests, and the people who are employers, the people that can hurt them or prevent them from being able to continue to act. So why don't we do it like the Greeks did and just draw it by lot, or do how we do today in our legal system, as we do it by jury? So we could actually just take people from by lot, have them function as a jury, and decide on which trades to make or not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm not so much saying we should have to do one. We have to do all these things exactly this way. I'd rather disprove. I'm more taking the point of we need to disprove this fallacy of the common good. That it's knowable the same in politics, the same way the common good is not knowable in an economy. So let's just return to what made us successful in the first place, which was a market government where we conduct trades instead of having this monopoly government. And the last thing is that some, you know, we know people aren't aren't equally valuable. But the problem is for them, you know, you think about the people at the bottom. You know, if I'm a criminal and a crook and I don't respect the commons and I act badly in all these places to rebel against the fact that this commons doesn't work for me, obviously we should forcibly remove these people, as Hans says. And I don't care. And I mean, I've gone from being a fairly pacifistic about this as I've learned more to being really comfortable with nooses and guillotines.
Right. Yeah.
I think the opposite is to get into say that, well, you know, there are people, though, there are a lot of people who do their civic duty, who serve in the military, who clean up the park, who are polite to each other in public. And those people, even if they do all those things right, they can't gain benefit from the market any longer because their labor isn't valuable enough. And so we have to say to ourselves, well, how do we, if you know, it used to be that when you, the reason you got, you know, markets were created by aristocracy or what you call nobles, or they were defended by the locals, and you create this market and you protect it. And then when you're in the market, you got to behave a certain way. We call that, you know, all these, you got to follow all these rules. But, you know, so you're in order to get access to the market benefits, you had to pay the cost of self-transformation. And once you left the market, then you could go. All right, you could go back to your home behavior. Well, the commons is our market right now. We could conduct this thing basically in all public spaces. So the problem is for these people is that, well, I do all my stuff, but I pay the tax of being a good person for the market, of not stealing, of not lying, of not cheating. Well, how do we pay this person for the service they provide? And that's where I come to. We should pay those people. We should pay them, but we should pay them not to have children, or to have one child, rather. Excuse me. If you have one child from these people, and you punish the wicked, in other words, the evil 80s that do all the crime, you're actually going to, over time, have a very pleasant place to live with. So my view is that we have a solution to offer, which is that, you know, you can't have takings from us any longer. We won't take it. And you can't have the big families that you want because you're doing too much damage to us because of it. But if you do all the right things, then why don't we pay you to be for your act of being a good citizen? Why? Because there's no other reason to be a good citizen.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to switch too much here, but right, you mentioned earlier about, you know, people have a tendency then, they want to go backwards. They want to have, you know, all, so they go for the authoritarian solution, right? Can you put that in perspective to us in what you see happening right now with Trump? I mean, is he good for America? Is it potentially good for international politics if he would actually get in? What's your view on this?
Well, first of all, I think it's very likely he can get in. It depends on which model you run. And there's a bunch of people, a bunch of nerds who are really good at running these models, and he looks pretty good. You can't tell in a political thing because these personality-driven things are too iffy. So I think he can get in just fine. What's happening is that Trump is an outsider, and we're calling in Caesar to throw the bums out. We're telling him we want to replace the government, and that's what we're asking him to do. That is really good, except that what's he really going to do?
He's going to build a wall.
Well, what I think he's going to do is he's going to stop the wealth at the expense of the tribe. And this is going to bother some people because some people, an awful lot of people actually, make a living at the expense of each other. And so he's going to stop that. Now we conservatives advocated for this stuff because we wanted to stop the union movement, which was doing the same thing. They're trying to extract rents, which we didn't want. And so the way we got around the union movement was we exported all the labor to punish them. Well, you know, now that we all understand that the labor movement's gone because we can export all this stuff because their labor isn't valuable, we can say that, well, you know, we can bring it back in and we can stop profiting at the expense of the people as long as the people will stop at profiting at the expense of others, right? So, I mean, I just view this as a big moral chess game we've been playing, and you know, we've sort of gotten to the point where the evidence is piled up. Marxism has sort of played its course.
In a question is if it has in America though. I mean, look at the popularity of Bernie. It is happening.
These are young people who are disproportionately from the lower classes and who are upset that they have been, they are facing what's now 10 years of economic stagnation and they're lost. So they're going to. So when you want an answer, just like the alt-right is going to back to totalitarianism, when you want an answer, you go to what you understand. Economics isn't an easy thing to understand. Self-organizing political systems aren't easy to understand. They're not easy to trust, and so people want what they can understand. They want their Caesar or their Pope, and we want our Caesar. I mean, that's what we want, and we want these things because we want certainty. We're not willing to wait any longer while somebody promises that it's going to work out, and then betrays us again. So I think that's all there is to be seen. I don't think there's anything else there.
Okay, so you know, both right and left is returning back. They're regressive. By the way, I never liked the way that the left got the term progressive, right? But so how do we actually progress, right? That isn't back to either of these. Explain that a bit more to us and what direction we can go to solve. Because look at just looking at America now, not even talking about Europe, but look at how incredibly polarized America is, right? 350 million people that are going to agree on one political leader basically to dictate to them. It doesn't bode well for the future, in my opinion.
Well, of course it doesn't, because the U.S. is an empire domestically, just like they're trying to make the Euro community into an empire in Europe. And we have 9 different nations here, maybe 10, and we don't want to be together. We like the fact that we have all this prosperity and this big safe military, but we actually kind of like the fact that we have this national economy. But basically, what we want to do is separate military and economic from social and normative, and I think we're going to have to do that the same way that you can't. I mean, Southern Italians are impossible for the North to integrate. You can't. Well, I mean, we can't integrate this many Mexicans,
right,
this many Muslims. No. It's just not possible.
No.
You can't escape this problem. It's not. Wishful thinking isn't a strategy, and faith isn't a tactic. These are bits of nonsense to delay the cost of paying the price of preserving the future. And so that's what they're doing. And so my view is that I want to provoke a civil war, precisely because I want one of the solutions to come out of it. The solution can be a market government, which would be much easier to work with, but preserve the scale. Or the solution can be dissolution, which it can be a devolution of the federal power over any and all social matters, non-monetary, non-military matters to the states. Or we can take it farther and just say, well, the federalism is done and we need to break up into the 9 nations that we actually represent.
And why do you divide it on 9 like that?
There's been a bunch of work on this. A book called The 9 Nations of North America. It's fairly famous. And I think J-Man online does the best job. He's got a great article over the past couple of days on UNZ Review. He's done a pretty good job of trying to show consistently the data supports that people vote genetically. And it's true.
Right.
People just
do.
We vote our genetic interests. The only time we don't vote our genetic interests is when there's so much wealth, it doesn't matter.
Right, exactly, because we can see that, you know, with Trump as a symbol for that, everyone is attacking him for being a racist, a white supremacist, right? That the very weak arguments, to a certain extent, that he's made so far in terms of trying to protect the border to the south, etc. That's enough to trigger all these people to start hating on the majority population. You know,
who cares? I mean, we just talked about, you know, we can talk about the science all day long. It's very simple. People vote their reproductive strategies. That's it. There's no more to it than that. In democracy, people vote their reproductive strategies. So in a position where you have this, you've conquered this continent, you know, killed off whoever was here before, conquer the continent, you're selling it off. Well, there's a lot of wealth to go around. So we're not fighting over scarce resources like people have been in the rest of the world. But now that's ended, right? You know, the great American expansion has ended. The empire that we inherited from the British after the Second World, that's become too expensive to manage without petrodollars. Mm-hmm. So that's all ending. You know, the economists are walking around showing me data, and I'm like, you know, I get very frustrated with this, but say, well, things are better than ever. Well, they're better than ever in what you're measuring. And what you're measuring, we know isn't right. So, I mean, you admit it isn't right. If it was right, we would know where productivity had gone. We would know a lot of things, but we don't, because we can't figure out where these things are, what's going on. So this is all a bunch of deception. So I just ignore it.
Tell us, you know, before we'll take a break here shortly, but tell us about the reasoning behind provoking a civil war and how this would be beneficial.
The reason you provoke a civil war is to create enough fear of loss, so as to raise the cost of the status quo such that a compromise is necessary. So somebody asked me about this the other day at one. Giving an interview, and I said, "Well, you know, look, America. People say America is one of the oldest governments and continuous governments in the world. That's sort of like not really right, because the Anglo-Saxon tradition is one of which you create a revolution with the purpose of coming to agreement." Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the English people, the British people, I'm going to go to the English people. English people have been conducting revolutions successfully for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we're really good at it. And so to me, I just look at this as, well, it's another opportunity to say that, to reorganize, to increase our controls over as the state increases in size, to control the state with new controls that befit its new scale, and prevent abuses of it. This whole corporatism, this whole belief in equality, this whole idea of the merchant world, this whole middle class fantasy that we can all be happy trading partners is nonsense. You know, we're the only people to believe that, because for the past 500 years, when we had complete military and economic and technological dominance over the rest of the world, selling that nonsense to ourselves was just self-fulfilling. But, you know, the truth is that we're sitting out here saying, well, you know, we no longer have complete military, cultural, technological, and economic advantage over the rest of the world, or if we do, it's not significant anymore. And moreover, we've moved a lot of the rest of the world into our territories, and now they're competing for us in our own governments. And this mercantile government we've produced, this corporation that supposedly acts on the behalf of all of us, is no longer in the service of the families and the tribe, but is in the interest only of the people who in the corporation, the state. So these people are acting in their own interests. They're not acting in our interests at all.
No.
Because they can't continue to do their profiteering by trading with other elites if we impinge upon their ability to conduct negotiations. So what we want to do is we want to deprive them of choice. We want to limit their ability to make those decisions. We want to limit them to fully informed voluntary transfer, productive full of our time transfer. We want to prohibit them from making profits at the expense of the tribe. And this will constrain them, and they don't want to do it. And they've got this great thing where they run a monopoly, and they're completely unaccountable. So let's change it. And so the only way to change that, you know, if you change it and you actually bring about a revolution, and there's fighting in the streets, I mean, this is really bad, right? Countries don't come back for it. There's a point at which we men get up and we say, that is a choice I am willing to make. I'm willing to to I'm not willing to go down. I'm willing to destroy it all unless we can come to a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you are back to negotiating on the same grounds. Because what they're trying to do is kill you off. So just beat them on their terms.
All right, Kurt, we're going to take a short break here, but let's just give out some of the details. Propertarianism.com is your website. Tell us about some of the things you have going on right now, and if there's anything you have, you know, either upcoming or something else that you, I guess, offer on the website that you want people to check out, take a look at.
No, I'm not a populist, right? I mean, I sort of do my intellectual work, and, you know, guys like you and others have found interest in me over the past couple of years. Everybody knows, I think, that I'm trying to put out the sort of something on the scale of, you know, Marx or Heidegger or Hegel or Kant or Smith and Locke and Hume. I'm trying to put out what I call the Bible of the West, which is to articulate our Western philosophy in rational or ratio-scientific terms. And that's my work. You know, what I do is fairly hard to make accessible to people, but I think the solutions I try to talk about are pretty useful in the current era. So anyway, that's all I try to do. I'm you know, an intellectual, and that's my job.
All right, very good. Propertarianism.com, folks. Definitely take a look. We'll have the link up on the website. We'll continue to talk more with Kurt in the second hour about the direction of the new right and everything else that's related to it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Our lives in your schemes and your power.
Okay, we have a second hour coming up here now on redicemembers.com, the website for subscribers, fans, and supporters. This is where we have all our shows available in full, and it allows us to keep this media endeavor going and growing. In hour two, coming up next, it's going to get brutal, harsh, as we face a potential reality of actions that will drive our declared enemies from our heartland. You definitely don't want to miss what Kurt has to say in the second hour. We charge €6 per month. We have subscriptions from 3 months up to 2 years available. You get instant access to over 1,000 radio programs going back to our start in 2006. We have videos, films, inside episodes, and more. We are working on website updates and a very exciting addition to our productions, and we are plotting for a social network in the background of everything as well. We've also recently reached out to people for volunteer work, and we have gotten so much email about this. We are continuing to look over these, and as we finalize a few of the other features that we're working on, as we, you know, beat some of these irons that are in the fire right now into some nice swords to partake in the fight, we will reach out to some of you and get this next phase initiated as well. Well, thank you so much, everyone. We could not do this without you. RedIceMembers.com is the website. We'll pick up hour two after a short break. We'll be right back.